From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. College days can sound like easy street. For whatever reason, for many students these days, they are not. Students are flooding mental health centers on campus. Some embrace them, counsel them. Some kick them out. What's going on? This hour on Point, an epidemic of anguish, it's being called, on American college campuses. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Why so much woe? Are students less resilient now, just more willing to talk about their troubles? And how should colleges handle it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Chronicle of Higher Education has turned a spotlight on all this with their series, An Epidemic of Anguish. The reporter for that series is Robin Wilson. She joins us now from Maryland. Robin, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And from Washington, Deputy Managing Editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education, Jennifer Ruark, is with us. Jenny, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Here's the sound of just one explanation of what's going on. Madison Hollerin was a freshman, University of Pennsylvania last year, committed suicide, jumping off the roof of a 9-story parking garage. She was a track athlete, began to struggle with mental health problems. She went to the counseling center at UPenn, but stopped going. She didn't like the experience. In May, in an interview with ESPN special there, her college friend Ashley Montgomery talked about the stresses.
In college, everything's just turned up one notch. Like in high school, when you're trying to balance athletic, social, and school, it's very possible. It's difficult, but it's possible. I think there's also a piece of when you're striving so much for perfection that it can manifest into, like, as a sickness when that's the case.
And let's get one more voice here. Freshman at Yale in 2013, Rachel Williams struggled with depression, eating disorder, was cutting herself. When she went to get her cuts checked out at Yale, the counseling center sent her home and told her she had to reapply to school for readmission with no guarantee that she would be readmitted. She talked with HuffPost Live's Mike Sachs last year.
I came into college with a lot of issues that I already had, but the pressure cooker is frustrating to live in. You hear a lot of people complaining about the stresses of their classes and their activities. And, you know, those stresses are real, but at the same time, it can kind of mask the real stresses. Like, it's not, for some reason, okay to say, I'm really depressed. I really need to talk to someone.
The Chronicle of Higher Education is all over higher education in this country, and they are calling it, in their series, an epidemic of anguish. Editor Jenny Ruark is with us from Washington. Robin Wilson, reporter here, is with us from Maryland. Jenny, that is quite a headline. An epidemic of anguish. Justify that with numbers, if you can. What is going on? Is there such a real change in volume of students looking for mental health counseling on campuses?
That's what counseling center directors say. They are seeing, or 89% of them are seeing more students with anxiety disorders, which has now become the number one problem that students seeking counseling are reporting. It's overtaken clinical depression, but still 58% of them are seeing more students with clinical depression. And even though between 2013 and 2014, the hours available for counseling went up by more than 50% as counseling centers tried to deal with this onslaught, nearly a third of them have waiting lists.
Robin, what are the explanations for this that you're hearing? I mean, you're looking at some colleges here where they've seen spikes over the last few years of 50%, 60% more of students coming in for mental health counseling. How do people explain why this is happening?
Students are seeking mental health counseling much earlier now, before they get to college. Many of them, some of the students I talked to, had been seeing therapists since they were in middle school. Some of them have been medicated as well and been taking medication for anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder. And so when they get to campus, they really expect the same kind of service that they were getting perhaps from private therapists when they were younger. And the stigma of mental health has been removed or at least declined enough so that there are more people in general, not just students, seeking therapy. And so, you know, those are some of the reasons, at least. And, you know, there is also the pressure of campus life. You talked to two students there at the beginning, mm-hmm. or talked about two students who are at very high pressure environments of the Ivy League. So for students being on their own for the first time without parental guidance, and then all the things that happen to you, breakups, bad grades, all that.
Breakup, bad grades, being on their own for the first time. Jenny, these things have always been part of many college lives, though. Do we have less resilient young people now, or have we just medicalized mental health from a younger age, made it normative for people who have a rough patch to talk to somebody about it?
Well, some counselors that Robin talked to for her story did feel that students are just less resilient today, that they are too accustomed to having barriers moved out of their way, and that they haven't learned coping mechanisms or ways to soothe themselves. But it's also true that, as you both alluded to earlier, the stigma on mental health has lifted somewhat. And so now about 1 in 4 students who are reporting to campus counseling centers are already on psychiatric medication. So it may be also a question of just recognizing problems earlier. They also, as Robin was saying, have had more support earlier on, which means more of them are arriving on campus in the first place who might not have made it to college before.
And how are colleges responding, Robin, in terms of beefing up mental health facilities? Is everyone doing it? Are they resisting it?
I wouldn't say resisting is quite the word. It takes a lot of money to do this, and campuses are doing a lot of things. Foremost, they're about educating students, but they're trying. And they're doing things like adding more counselors to their staffs, whether it's during certain times that they bring on temporary or part-time counselors. They're having group therapy sessions so that they can pack more students in to certain sessions on, say, eating disorders or certain common themes of things that students present with. They're doing all sorts of things, even having mental health kiosks that look like ATMs, where a student can go up, say what his or her symptoms are, and perhaps get some kind of diagnosis and a direction for further help. They also need to do a lot to try to help students coordinate their care, because students are without their parents who may have helped them, say, with medication that they're taking. So there are coordinators who help students with their medication, with, say, seeing psychiatrists and therapists, but then also helping them run interference with faculty members should they need some type of accommodation because of their mental health issues.
How do colleges feel about getting in the middle of all that? Do they feel like it's their job, their responsibility, or it's not, but they have to, or they may suffer reputational consequences?
The people I talked to said that they think this is their job, and it certainly is expected of them by parents now, and so that they really are about educating the whole student. And that means taking care of them, you know, in the classroom, but also outside of the classroom in terms of their other needs. And so I think many of them do think it's their job. It's just that it's a struggle to meet that demand. Now, certainly, they're also concerned for the things you talked about. They're concerned about what happens when they have mentally ill students on their campus who need more significant help than a campus can offer, or students who perhaps may be suicidal. Those are real dangers to a campus as well as to the student. And so campuses are reacting differently to those problems.
We've seen that, of course, at Virginia Tech and elsewhere. In your piece with this big headline, An Epidemic of Anguish, you write about sort of fork in the road here, different ways of responding to mental health challenges at different colleges. You look at the two instances, one at College of William and Mary and the other at California Institute of Technology, Caltech. In a nutshell, what was the difference between the way that these two institutions came at problems that their own students faced?
The nutshell is that one campus, William and Mary, called the parents of the student almost immediately when he came into the counseling center and talked to the counselor and said some things that made the counselor think that student needed significant help and was perhaps suicidal. At Caltech, the campus counseling service did not reach out to the parents because the student didn't want them to. And so that was the major difference in a nutshell. And that student was kept on campus without then contact with the parents and with a hospital. So one One campus sent the student to his parents and a hospital to prove he'd gotten help to get back in, and that was William and Mary. And the other kept the student on campus and attempted to treat him that way.
Jenny, we see that fork in the road shows up rather frequently. Some colleges say, okay, let's get in some counseling here. And others say, you should probably leave this institution. Go and work on this outside of the college setting and come back to us when you have evidence that these aren't issues. That's become controversial in its own way, Jenny.
It has. I mean, the large majority of college campuses do reserve the right to refer a student outside of campus for treatment because, as Robin said, they are primarily educational institutions. If you needed to have, weekly dialysis treatments, you would be referred off campus. So in each case, colleges are trying to make sure that they can meet the need, and if they feel that they can't, referring students off campus. I think another difference that's demonstrated by the two cases that Robin explored in her story is that it often comes down to a counselor's judgment. How critical is the situation? And some 69% of college campuses have seen increases in crises requiring immediate response. But with the waiting list that they have, they're sort of doing triage on a case-by-case basis and trying to figure out what's necessary.
And, of course, Robin, quickly before the break here, it's not just referral off campus. Sometimes it's you're out of school until you are in better shape.
That happens, and it happens mostly at elite institutions like Yale, you talked about at the beginning of the program, where students do have to reapply. The process is not as rigorous as applying in the first place, but it can be daunting for students, especially those who are having mental health problems.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are looking at the high and surging demand for mental health services on American college campuses, at what's going on and the different ways that colleges are responding. Robin Wilson and Jennifer Ruark are with us from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Their headline on all this on campus, An Epidemic of Anguish. Daniel Eisenberg got a grant from the NCAA to produce a series of short videos with the hope of reaching out to student athletes under stretch. And here's one of them. Former University of Michigan football player Will Heiniger described his experience with depression as a student athlete.
I was hit by the perfect storm of stressors. The pressure of getting good grades. Competing for playing time. I was supposed to gain weight and get faster. And back home, my parents' marriage was crumbling.
A lot of things can come together to put pressure on students. And then, of course, you get real, real nightmare scenarios for students and colleges and everybody. Here's Lucinda Roy. She was the head of the English department in 2007, when 23-year-old Sungwi Cho killed 33 people at Virginia Tech in April of that year. She tutored Cho privately after a poetry teacher had kicked him out of her class, the shooter, because she was afraid of him. In an interview later with CBS, she said she learned that Cho had gone to the counseling center, but the response then from the center was limited.
I learned that he had gone over repeatedly, not just once, but was never really examined. You get very, very few opportunities to help someone who's mentally disturbed, very few. And when you get them, you must take them.
And colleges are sort of terrified that if somebody slips through that net and becomes, well, in Cho's case, a mass killer or anything like it, they have a problem at many, many levels. We're going to hear in just a moment from the head of student life counseling at The Ohio State University. Let me get a couple callers, if I may, first. Sue in Buffalo, New York. Sue, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. The reason I called was over 30 years ago, I was a crisis counselor at a university. I was a student, and they had a peer counseling hotline. I don't think that the issues are all that different than I was a counselor. It was an anonymous hotline, which I think made people feel more comfortable calling. And I also want to say that with a school like Yale and other Ivy Leagues, that for the first time one stressor was that they were no longer at the top of their class. They were in with peers who were just as successful. And that was a huge stressor. But I really don't think that the issues have changed. I think that an anonymous hotline helped because people didn't have to worry about any ramifications and we would make appropriate referrals.
Yeah. Sue, let us wade in right there, if we may, and I appreciate your call from Buffalo. Let's wade in with someone who's dealing with a lot of students all the time these days. Robin Wilson, Jennifer Ruark, please stand by. With us right now from Indianapolis, Indiana, is Mickey Sharma, Director of Student Life Counseling and Consultation at Ohio State, President of the Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors. Mickey Sharma, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What about this generation and its coping skills? How do you size them up against previous eras?
Well, I think with this generation, the coping skills are an area that many of the students who are on college campuses today are really struggling with. So you have university counseling center staff who are working with students to increase their coping skills and to further enhance in students their own personal levels of resiliency. So we're working with students to help prevent them from falling down, but also working with them that when they have fallen down, how do we help them get back up?
Are they not as good at self-soothing or coping as previous generations? And if not, why not?
Well, I think that's one of the things that's happened is the coping, the resiliency is not as strong as it was previously. And to your question as to why not, I think it's related to this generation of students that are living in a very, very fast-paced society. And there's additional stressors that are placed on students who are leading hectic and very scheduled lives from a very young age. And so it's taken a toll on their ability to truly, fully cope most effectively with all the stressors in their lives.
Is it also, I mean, do they look around? I mean, these were kids who grew up with 9/11 right in their laps, very, very young. We've had economic meltdown since then, maybe less confidence of a job and career and lots of things when they get out of college. Do those come into play, or every generation has its atmospheric churn?
Well, yes, every generation has a turn, but what you're talking about is the national and international level stressors can then come down to the micro level and have an impact on the individual student and the person who's grown up in our society today. Yes, that happens, and I think that the pressures on today's student are also greater than they were in previous generations.
What about their familiarity with counseling, perhaps their comfort with it? And for that matter, I'm looking here at something like a quarter of students are showing up on psychotropic medicine before they, you know, even get in deeply into college. Are they set up by experience and expectation to look for this kind of help, Mickey?
Yes, absolutely. As Jennifer, I believe, had mentioned previously, we have more students on campus today who have had previous mental health treatment than any time before. So this means that higher education has become more of an option for more people in our society, which is a good thing, but it also means that universities need to be best prepared to manage the students who are on our campus today.
I mean, I'm looking here at numbers. Robin Wilson, this is from some reporting that says that several analyses have found rates of completed suicide among non-college students, 18 to 24, are higher than those in college. That suggests a whole generation in and out of college that has got some mental health headwinds.
I think you're right. I don't think it's just students on college campuses, but then there are all the additional stresses and strains when you're on a campus, especially on an elite campus, as many people have said. And so these are students who are looking for help when they come to campus for a variety of reasons, and their parents expect that kind of help. And I think that's important, too, and parents are very involved. They're in touch with their students, their kids, on college campuses by text or, you know, other means. And the parents I spoke to fully expected the campus to be able to fill right in for any private therapy the student may have had or any problem that may come up that may be new on a campus.
Mickey Sharma,
they're paying a lot of money, after all, in a lot of cases.
Yeah, Mickey Sharma at Ohio State, is that realistic for parents to expect that the university is going to move into that role of mental health sort of supervisor for their students just because they show up on campus. Do you have the resources? Is that a reasonable understanding of a university's role?
I think the reasonable understanding of the university's role is to do everything that particular institution can do to provide support to students to be academically successful. We have on our main campus 58,000 students. We are not in a position to provide individual counseling to 58,000 students. However, we can offer a variety of different services to many students to best meet their needs. And not all 58,000 students are in need of individual counseling.
Yeah, thank heavens. But the numbers appear to be up. Plenty of listeners calling in here. Tom in Johnson, Vermont. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you think? What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I'm a recent graduate of a small liberal arts college, and I found a lot of students, along with having to balance social and academic and studying and all that, also weren't having enough money after the first year or so because of the lack of funding for scholarships and for financial aid, that they were also having to get jobs off campus. And that was adding into the whole stress of not having enough time to do anything and having to worry about finances and if they're going to be able to, you know, pay for to continue going to school.
Did you see it showing up in terms of their mental health, Tom?
Yeah, I had a few friends who, in particular, who had to, you know, they went to classes for 8 hours a day and then went and worked for 5 hours afterwards, and they started having anxiety problems very quickly. And one of them actually had to be the school I went to referred to the counseling center and actually had another student that was assigned to make sure that she was going to the counseling center.
They really want to know that something's going on. That's interesting. I want to look at both those. Mickey, first on the cost of college and work. I mean, people have worked to put themselves through college for a long time. I worked all the way through college. It doesn't mean that there weren't rocky times, but it's not a brand new thing, though 5 hours a day sounds pretty rough.
I think the what you're getting at is both the balance of work, academics, your personal, your social life, trying to balance all of those can be stressful, and the financial pressure. So there's the individual financial pressure that an individual student is dealing with. We also work with students who are also dealing with financial pressures back home. We have students who are working and sending money back to their family. We have students who's working whose mom or dad or primary caregiver has lost a job, and that's adding financial pressure to them as well. Or concern that, how's the family going to afford to send my sibling to college, and I don't want to use all the fiscal resources of the family. So there's many ways those fiscal pressures are felt.
But you don't want students flipping out. I mean, but that's real. That's very real pressure for anybody. A call from Nashville here. Tom, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Tom. My daughter actually did have to get checked into a mental hospital for about a week. And it was a culmination of financial pressures all through her 4 years of college. She only had 3 courses left to go. But when she would get these large scholarships, they would reduce her financial aid so that she never got the use of any of the money. It just all washed out. So every time she had a job, it would be the same thing when she worked on campus. And so everything seemed to just beat her down and down and down and down throughout the whole process. And it was just totally unfair.
Tom, as a parent, in that case, were you up to speed on all this going on? Did it come as a surprise to you when suddenly she was going off for some treatment in a facility for a week?
It did surprise us. We did not know how bad it was. Of course, she wanted to just keep it in to herself and take care of her own problems and everything and not involve other people. But, you know, when you have troubles like this, you just can't do that. And I know she was getting counseling for the university, but she felt betrayed by the university's counselor.
It's a very tough situation. We're looking at what the Chronicle of Higher Education is calling an epidemic of anguish on American college campuses, counseling, and all the rest. Robin Wilson, reporter with the Chronicle on higher ed. What is the university's responsibility or freedom to share information on counseling with parents, family, anybody?
What I heard from counselors on campuses is that if a student was, you know, in sufficient trouble, they would mostly contact the parents. I checked on that. Now, there are many who don't, who follow the student's wishes. You know, this parent, Tom, who you just talked to, talked about his daughter feeling betrayed by the campus counselor. And so that campus counselor, it sounds like, ended up deciding that his daughter needed more help than the campus could give, and she was referred to a hospital where she spent maybe a week. Sometimes that's what has to happen, whether parents and students want that to or not. If you've been successful in high school, gotten yourself to a great college, but then find yourself being shown the door by campus counselors, it's a huge disappointment. You're reeling at that point. You don't know if you'll get back.
You
do feel betrayed, and yet the counselors I spoke to who had been in that position of having to refer students said that this is something that's necessary in many cases, and students and parents needed to step back and take care of the students' mental health.
Why are they shipping them off campus for treatment or even just out of campus life? Are they afraid of responsibility or even liability if they keep them on campus? Are they under-resourced to actually give them the treatment they need? What's the package of reasons, Robin?
If you're sending a student to a hospital for mental health concerns, you don't have that kind of facility on campus. And so many campuses also think that the student needs to step out of the campus setting and focus on his or her mental health as opposed to staying on the campus and conducting life as usual, that even though maybe parents and students want to pretend that at that point life is usual or the student will get back to it tomorrow, campuses don't think that's always in the best interest of the student. And so there you have the conflict and the problem.
Mickey Sharma, what's the break point for you at Ohio State? When is it, let's work through this? When is it better go off, leave campus, and get treatment?
So when it comes to the issue of hospitalization, when we are looking at a student who needs to be moved to an inpatient care facility, most of the times that's because there's concern about this person's well-being such that he or she cannot maintain their own personal safety. And we will look at situations where what's in an individual's best interest. And so every student's goal is to graduate. There are many ways to get from point A to point B. There are times where someone's mental health issues are so significant, they're going to impede a student's ability to be academically successful. Maybe they need to leave campus, get some treatment off campus for a little bit of time, return to campus, and then successfully graduate. So it's really down on a case-by-case basis, Tom.
Do you find that students and parents resist that recommendation, or is it not a recommendation? Is it a, you're out of here?
Well, the counseling center, my counseling center, we are not empowered to remove students from campus. We certainly can make recommendations, but students are making choices. The piece where students are getting removed from campus that you're alluding to are likely because of some behavior that the student has engaged in on campus. No student should be subjected to any sanction for having a mental health illness or a medical illness. However, if a student engages in a particular behavior that violates the student code of conduct, that can be addressed by the university.
Mickey, we just got you for another half minute here. To read about an epidemic of anguish on campuses is unnerving, is disturbing for people. You feel sad for the kids experiencing that, and you wonder why it's happening. Would you use that phrase to describe what you see?
An epidemic of anguish. What I would look at it as, we have an opportunity to work towards making all of our campuses more mental health friendly. Not just the counseling center staff, but how do we educate all of our faculty, all of our staff, all of our students to recognize signs and symptoms of mental health students or struggles in their counterparts, in the other students, and how do they refer them and get them to the place that they need to be, and how do they have those conversations, and how do we continue to reduce the stigma around mental health across all of our campuses?
Mickey Sharma in Indianapolis today, the Director of Student Life Counseling and Consultation Services at The Ohio State University. Mickey, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at the high-end surging demand for mental health services on American college campuses, looking at what's going on and the different ways colleges are responding. Robin Wilson and Jennifer Ruark are with us from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Their big piece series is headlined An Epidemic of Anguish. You can link to some of that at our website, onpointradio.org. Drexel University became the first U.S. college to set up a mental health kiosk on campus, kind of an ATM for quick sizing up of mental health. Here's Paul Furtois, Associate Director of Counseling Services at Drexel, in an interview with the Chronicle of Higher Education last week, explaining how the kiosk works.
You're offered a series of questions and options, and you begin a mini-survey. It takes a minute or two, 10 to 20 questions, depending on the survey. And it asks you different experiences about your feelings, thoughts, actions, and then gives you feedback as to whether your concerns rise to the level that warrant speaking to a mental health professional. It puts them in charge in a way that's convenient, free, confidential.
The machine asks you a few questions, and then it's kind of a, well, should you go for counseling or things kind of okay? You can see some video of how that works at our website, onpointradio.org. Lots of response online here. Ian says, the lack of coping mechanisms will only get worse in the future as human interaction continues to be replaced by tech. Well, yeah, a lot of screen time. I don't know if that's the reason. Anna says poor nutrition is often the ignored cause of depression. Schools ought to make sure students are receiving proper nutrition, not just food, but nutrition. Liz in New Orleans looks out and says, I don't see soft kids. I think they feel isolation because they see a dramatically different world ahead of themselves than even their professors can prepare them for. There are some big problems coming down for the pipeline for them. Maybe that's what they feel. I want to welcome into our conversation from New Haven, Connecticut, Charles Anderson, Director of Counseling at the University of New Haven, was Associate Director in the Counseling Center at Virginia Tech from 2011 to 14 and at the College of William and Mary from 14 to 15. Charles Anderson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having me.
You have written about this, and you're paying a lot of attention, among other things, to how legal advisors on campuses, their voices are pretty strong here, that campuses are very attuned to legal liability that may emerge if they don't confront mental health issues. How is that playing out?
Well, that is the thesis of the essay I wrote for the Washington Post back in May. And yes, I do see that the legal voice is really quite strong in the campus and university community, and my sense is that has been a shift since the tragedy at Virginia Tech. And of course, I'm in particular pointing to my experience there and watching how that evolved over time. And I think certainly the risk of having a liability focus as we look towards the challenges of providing mental health care kind of steers us in a direction that is not quite a therapeutic direction. I think it's more of a legalistic direction, and I'm not sure it sets us up to serve students the way we would want to.
Well, one could imagine that perspective, that concern about legal liability might get campuses to get involved more aggressively, or it might lead them to want to wash their hands of it. Which direction do you see it leading campuses more prominently?
Well, sadly, I think it's more in the direction of wanting to wash hands. You know, I think if some of the resources that are put into the sort of the attempt to create a maximally safe environment by beefing up, say, security resources and administrative resources, and if that's to the extent that is to the neglect of the requirements of counseling services and health services, I think you find yourself in a situation where you're not actually able to provide the kind and level of services that you would really want to.
Robin Wilson, did you find that in your reporting for the Chronicle of Higher Education? Charles Anderson writes, when we allow the legal voice into ascendancy, and, you know, after Virginia Tech and a lot more, you can see why people might be concerned. But he writes, we may win at safety and liability, but we lose at compassion and humanity. Do you see campuses leaning away from mental health engagement because it may bring safety or liability issues to their door, or leaning in?
I don't think that campuses would tell you that's happening, but there have been instances where the legal concerns of a campus run right up against the mental health concerns of a student. And it happened at the University of Oregon, where a student who said that she had been sexually assaulted was seeing a therapist on campus and then decided to sue the university for what she saw as a lack of response over taking care of her or addressing the sex assault. And in that case, lawyers for the university, in defending themselves against this suit, went ahead and accessed the mental health records on campus from her counselor. And it was quite a clash between the counseling service on campus and the lawyers on campus who needed to protect the institution in terms of legal liability. And so that doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen. And in these cases, colleges feel that they need to protect themselves. And in fact, they actually found that what they did was something that then Congress is now trying to address in terms of whether that's the right way to go.
On the privacy front, of course, sometimes there's a need to know, but there's also obviously a big interest in privacy here. Dawn in Columbia, South Carolina. Dawn, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering what your panel thought about James Holmes, the fact that he was working on his PhD and seeing his psychiatrist and had disclosed that he was homicidal and thought about killing people three times a day. And
Before the mass shooting in Aurora in Colorado, yeah, Charles Anderson, what about that? You saw Virginia Tech after the shooting there. We all watched James Holmes and then eventually heard that he had spoken with a counselor about this. How far should privacy go?
Well, that is a great complexity, of course, and that is the point at which we have, I think, legal permission at any rate to move in a direction that preserves the safety of the person themselves or persons that they may have indicated they may want to harm in the future. And you know, that is the spot and the place at which we as counselors have to make a decision, and hopefully we make a good decision to respond to what we're actually hearing, to make a good assessment of the person in the place that they're at, and to then bring to bear resources that will either, again, protect them from harm to themselves or protect the public from harm in that direction.
I mean, do you think, Charles, that part of this is looking out at the world and seeing a scarier place? If they look at war tensions, economic woe, earlier generations went through world wars.
Yes, I appreciate the question. I really am not in the camp of people who look at this generation and see a sort of generic problem. I really don't see any lack of coping resources or any significant difference in people. You know, if you're a counselor, you're seeing people with all different levels of coping abilities and levels of resilience and presenting issues. And really our task is to see clearly what is right in front of us and really treat the person that is presenting to us, regardless of where they are. I don't think it's helpful to have something in mind that says this generation is such and so. I think that ends up to be a potential obstacle to doing the good work of therapy.
Then why do you see so much more demand, that's being described in the Chronicle of Higher Education and elsewhere? How do you explain it?
Well, I think in some respects it's a measure of some success that we've had as a profession in beginning to destigmatize the seeking of treatment of mental health services. I see that as a positive, the idea that students feel more comfortable asking for help when they need it. This is a positive development, and I think if we're positioning ourselves to actually respond to that difference, that potentially positive difference, and we position ourselves with the resources to be able to respond effectively, then we're doing the good ethical work of care and treatment that we want to do.
Linda in Beverly, Massachusetts. Linda, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I experienced my daughter's second semester freshman year of college with she has a severe eating disorder, mm-hmm. and her declining health got to the point where the school was like, she cannot stay here any longer. And sometimes the people who are experiencing the illness don't realize just how sick they are because they're so deep into it. And what I found the college did a really good job at was saying, if you do not leave, this is the course that we're going to have to take. But they offered her to do like a diminished care leave. And there will be lots of things that benchmarks she will have to, you know, make, mm-hmm. if she decides that she's, when she is well enough to go back. But it kind of took it out of the hands of us as the parents having to, like, step, mm-hmm. you know, and tell her what to do. The doctor did not have to, her regular doctor did not have to, you know, kind of pull her, what do I want to say? There's something that they can do to really force it. And
the college kind of took responsibility here. What do they say if she didn't leave to deal with her eating disorder? And I'm glad she's dealing with it. But what did the college say would happen if she didn't leave to deal with it, Linda?
Well, it's a lot of the things that I've been hearing on the radio where, you know, they will, if if she didn't leave, they would have had to force her to leave. And I don't think that, and then she probably would have had to, like, reapply. I can't really remember because it was a very mm-hmm. distressing time. Yeah. But I was just very grateful that the woman who worked with her from the, was the counseling center and also their, like, on-campus medical center. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, my daughter was not in a state of being able to make really good decisions for herself. And through the guidance of them and with me, my daughter, you know, did take the leave. And, you know, she's working on her recovery now. And so she knows that if she wants to go back, that's still an option. She will have to do, you know, meet a lot of criteria in order to do so, but it's still there. So,
Linda, we've got it. It's a fascinating story that talk about in loco parentis, college really getting involved there. And for you, that was welcome. We wish your daughter a speedy return to a real healthy state so she can study and thrive there. Jennifer Ruark is with the Chronicle of Higher Education, deputy managing editor there. Jennifer, there's a parent who's very happy to have the college step in and play a forceful role in guiding their child, daughter in this case, toward better mental health.
Yes, and I think parents in general are going to differ in whether they think that it's more important, whether they think that their child's situation is serious enough that the child needs, excuse me, to be off of campus, or whether they think, you know, this can be dealt with on campus, don't break stride, keep going towards graduation. So really it's up to college counselors and in coordination with the families to try to make a proper determination.
Bob in Normal, Illinois. Bob, thank you for calling. You're on.
Sure. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I agree with all of what your panel is saying, everyone that's been on. As I mentioned, I was 45 before I was diagnosed bipolar. I just happen to be a student right now taking a weight training class to help deal with it. But I also, we're starting a group around the semicolon movement. So our first meeting is tonight, actually, and to students ending mental illness stigma. And I've heard the word stigma mentioned several times, and that's what we're trying to alleviate a little bit. It's good to hear that even being one of the most cash-strapped state in the country right now, Illinois State University has all of these things in place. We have five deans on duty that are licensed psychiatrists. We have a psychologist. We have a 24-hour hotline here in town that's been going for at least 20 years that refers people, even students. It's something, and like Liz from New Orleans said, it's not soft students. It happens to athletes. There was a case here in town of a young man who was a state champion swimmer, had a full-ride scholarship to a Division I swimming program where there are very little slots available, mm-hmm. and killed himself right before he graduated last May. And his father made sure that they addressed his mental illness in his obituary. And then there have been several cases over the last 2 years. One weekend we had a young man and a young woman commit suicide in the same dormitory. And that really shook campus. So I'm just glad to hear that the Chronicle is addressing this. It is becoming more addressed in the public, and I look forward to reading their article.
Bob, I appreciate your call from Normal there in Illinois. Charles Anderson, do you think over time, and Bob's pretty happy with what he's seeing on in his local scene there, but does this mean a shift in resources away from, I don't know what, from football stadia to mental health centers? Is that
called for? It's a great question. It really is. I think, you know, as we're looking at the demand that we're seeing in college counseling centers, we're looking at colleges looking towards growth and towards attracting new students. I think if we can also turn our attention to recognizing that with that kind of growth, you will need a certain kind of infrastructure to be able to respond to that growth and to be able to do the work that we do in an ethical way. I think that does mean a look at resources, a look at institutional priorities. And, you know, I really think that, again, being able to do the work of counseling in an ethical way requires that we see students more frequently, that we don't have wait lists that are 3 weeks long, that we don't have waits between appointments that are 3 weeks to 4 weeks in the interval. I think in that respect, we're not doing the ethical work of counseling when we're letting that happen. And if we need to make the better case ourselves for what we need, then so be it.
It's a challenge. Colleges and students rising in many different ways. Charles Anderson is director of the Counseling Center at the University of New Haven in Connecticut. Charles, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Robin Wilson and Jennifer Ruark at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Series there, headline, An Epidemic of Anguish. Robin, thanks to you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Ruark, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your insights on air and online. Whether you're listening live or on podcast or later, it's all great reading. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.